This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning, and welcome to the programme at the start of another week. And we begin by thinking about forgiveness, because we're talking about it on the programme today. When, if ever, in your life have you forgiven someone? Or maybe you haven't. Maybe you are still bearing a grudge, still angry, and cannot find it within yourself to forgive. Should we always forgive? What did forgiving do for you? It could have been for something really serious or really trivial. I would love to hear from you this morning. If you have managed it, is it easier said than done? Get in touch with me in the usual way. 84844 is the number to text. You can also email me via the website. You can contact us on social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. Or if you'd like to WhatsApp me or leave me a voice note, it's 03700 100 444. We're discussing forgiveness for a couple of reasons. There's a new series beginning here on Radio 4 today, Forgiveness, Stories from the Frontline, which explores how people manage to restore their lives after something truly awful has occurred to them. And also, you may have seen Esther Jai, the mother of the murdered teenager Brianna Jai, speaking to Laura Kunzberg, saying she would be open to meeting the mother of her daughter's killer in a profound act of compassion, one that really makes you stop and think, do I have the capacity to do that? So this morning, please get in touch with me about your thoughts and experiences of forgiveness. Also on the programme, Ambika Mudd, after her standout performance as Dr. Shruti in This Is Going to Hurt, she's bagged herself the lead in a new Netflix adaptation of the David Nichols bestseller One Day. And are you a grandparent? How's it going? Effortless? Or do you wish you could take a class to help you with the role? Maybe you're the parent who wishes you could send your folks to grandparenting classes. Well, grantinatal classes are a thing. We'll be finding out more. 84844 is the text number once again. And of course, if you want to send me an email, just head to our website. First, forgiveness. Speaking over the weekend, Esther Jai, the mother of Brianna Jai, told the BBC's Laura Kunzberg how she felt about the idea of forgiving her daughter's killers and said she would be open to meeting the mother of one of the two teenagers who killed her daughter after seeing her looking completely broken. We can hear some of the interview now.
I don't carry any hate for either of them because hate is such a harmful emotion to the person that's holding that. But with regards to forgiving them, I think that... No, not really.
Scarlett's mother has thanked you for your compassion. Is there anything that you would want to say to her?
I think that I would like to say that if she did want to contact me and she does want to speak, then I'm open to that. I'd like to understand more how their life was and what they went through, and I also want her to know that I don't blame her for what her child's done, and I also want her to know that I understand how difficult being a parent is in this current day and age with technology and phones and the internet, and how hard it is to actually monitor what your child is on. So yeah, if she ever wants to speak to me, I'm here.
Esther Jai, mother of Brianna, And returning for a second season on Radio 4, Forgiveness, Stories from the Frontline, explores how you survive and restore your life when something truly appalling is done to you. And please do keep sharing your own stories with me. That text number 84844. Well, Marina Cantacuzino presents the programme and founded the charity The Forgiveness Project in 2004. And Marion Partington is an author whose sister Lucy went missing in 1973 when Lucy was 21 and Marion 26. In 1994, Marion discovered Lucy had been killed by Fred and Rosemary West. I spoke to both of them earlier, and I started by asking Marina why she chose to focus on forgiveness.
Well, it all started actually for me with the Iraq War. I was one of those people on the march in February 2003. I was furious. I was holding a banner saying, "Not in my name." It was a peace march against the invasion of Iraq. I was convinced the harder you come down on people, the more they regroup in a hardened and resistant way. And so my work around forgiveness, you could say, was a counter-protest, and it grew out of anger. I wanted to find stories which were counterintuitive, countercultural, which were about compassion, empathy, and forgiveness, because the language at the time was so bellicose and so angry and about tit-for-tat and payback. And so over the course of a year, I thought, well, I'll just try, as a journalist, which I was, I'll just try and find stories about forgiveness and empathy, stories of victims who had found peaceful solutions to conflict. And along the way, I also found and interviewed perpetrators, people who had transformed their aggression into a force for peace. And that's how it began.
And the first series, which I've listened to, is it gives you such an insight into quite challenging situations. I think it's very easy for people to talk about forgiveness, but these stories that you've selected really take us to a place where it's hard to imagine how somebody has the capacity to even start thinking about it in a way that's not purely anger. Which brings me to you, Marion. Please, could you tell us about the moment of realization when you decided to think about forgiveness, about what happened to your sister?
Yes, well, it's a very complex, long story because Lucy was missing for 20 years and we found out what happened to her after 20 years. And so I happened to begin to go on Buddhist retreats then, which actually gave me space to allow the unthawing of feelings that had been on hold for so long, and the raw feelings of grief and rage and came up very strongly. But then on these retreats, they go on for 5 days and you spend a lot of time just confronting yourself, really. And I just had this moment where I was looking at all this unresolved pain that had come to the surface and wondering how to go forward with my life, how to live in a way that was not going to be corrupted and damaged for the family, really. You know, I wanted to know, how can I live in a way that isn't going to bring more harm into this situation? And I just saw four root possible ways of dealing with this. One was denial, which definitely doesn't work as a long-term solution, but it's, you know, it's part of the process. One was dumping it on others. The most extreme form of that would be murder. Mm. One was letting it corrode me, eat away at me, my life, and the most extreme expression of that would be suicide. And then then this word forgiveness came into my mind, and I just had this feeling that this would be the way out. This would be a healthy way forward. I had no idea how it could come about, what it actually involved, but I just had this sense of this was the most creative, imaginative way forward. And so I actually made a vow to try and forgive the people who'd murdered Lucy. And the first thing I experienced when I got home from the retreat was murderous rage. So that was the kind of the beginning of the path for me, having to look at my own potential for harm and eventually over the years, looking at, you know, in more detail about, yes, I can see that I've been a perpetrator. I've been a victim. I've been a bystander. These are all aspects of being human. And we have a choice about how we live and how we can live in a way that brings something good or something meaningful out of this experience.
And Marion, you can have that thought, and you had it on the Buddhist retreat, but thinking it and realising, yes, this is maybe the best route to take, but actually going down that route are two very different things, aren't they?
They are. They are.
So how did you, what did it involve to actually get to a place of forgiveness? Is it forgiveness or is it compassion?
It's taken a very long time. I continue to go on Buddhist retreats. I have a sort of spiritual parameters that disciplines that I've lived this journey through. and it's very much about just becoming aware of what is actually going on in me in this moment. And it's something about, this is everyday life. Yes, this isn't going on. I've seen this on a retreat. But the question is, I never really liked the word forgiveness. It just didn't really seem to ring true. It was a bit dead. I used to say it was barnacled with eons of piety. It was just encrusted. And eventually, on another retreat, actually, but I did experience what I call an authentic moment of compassion for Rosemary West, but it didn't come about until I'd had to really look at my own life and get to know myself in its complex and confused, wounded detail. Finding some compassion for that within myself, I could suddenly see that this, I just was struggling again with grief. The grief goes on and on. But I'd actually asked the Chan master of the retreat, you know, what can I do about this? And he just said the words, just know that your suffering is helping to relieve the suffering of others. And I didn't really know what would that mean in everyday life? But it really led me to a profound feeling of compassion, which means empathy with suffering, which means connecting very deeply with the sort of flawed humanity that we all carry. Yeah. And realizing that actually I couldn't really write off anybody. It just felt like writing people off, turning away the denial route, just was damaging to, you know, it felt like it would shrivel my heart.
And I know you, and it's led you down a road of doing a lot of work with restorative justice, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But Marina, I just want to come to you on the theme of forgiveness and talk about the comments over the weekend by the mother of Brianna Jai, speaking after the sentencing of the two teenagers who killed her daughter last year. She said she couldn't forgive the teenagers, but she'd be open to meeting the mother of her daughter's killer. What did you think of that? What did you think of what she said?
Well, precisely that kind of story that led me down this path, actually, because I realised we live in such a unforgiving and brutal world that when the mother of a murdered teenager reaches out with compassion and empathy, the very person that society expects them to hate, actually, people's hearts are opened. People are moved by this. People want to hear these stories of hope in such bleak times. And, you know, it's headline news today because of that. You know, we're all in awe where our lives are somehow enriched from having heard her say that.
And
so these are exactly the kind of stories I wanted to share, because I could see that it helped people deal with their own unresolved grievances.
Did her
words, own pain.
Yeah. Did her words strike a chord with you, Marion?
Definitely. I think what struck a chord with me, yeah, it came back to this thing, she didn't forgive them, but she wanted to meet. And I think that is a difference between compassion. She felt compassion for the mother of the daughter who killed her daughter. So, you know, not long really after it had all happened. And she reached out. And I think what struck me about her words, she said, I'd like to understand more how their life was and what they were going through.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, there was always this big question, how did the West lives get to this state? The criminal justice system doesn't look at the context of crime particularly, you know, it doesn't show this picture of lives moving in this direction. What were the influences? How did this come about? Why did it come about? So this need for understanding, which may not be possible in some ways, but it is a very deep human need. And this is where really the restorative justice comes in, because it gives an opportunity to meet with people who've committed serious harm, from my perspective, and listen to them and realize that they have nearly always come from what you could call a ruined childhood. They have been often abused sexually and experienced neglect, the effects of poverty. Nowadays, in this case that we're looking at, you know, the social media had a huge part to play, the corrupting images that influence people's minds. And her need to sort of bring something out of that too, you know, you want to make things different so that this won't happen to anyone else. That's the feeling.
And and as part of your process, I understand you wrote a letter to Rosemary West. Why did you decide that was something you needed to do?
Well, I would put this again in the context of this is all takes a long time for me. You know, it was 1994 that we found out what happened to Lucy. It was 2000 when I had that moment of authentic compassion for the fact that she's demonized, locked away for the rest of her life, had suffered horrendous abuse in her childhood. And the question I was asking was, you know, what would have made a difference? And I think, you know, it comes back to, for me, to love. If she had known love, then these things might not have happened. So I just felt that I wanted her to know something of the journey I'd been on. I wasn't writing to say I forgive you. I was writing to say I do not feel any hostility towards you. And also realizing the huge isolation that she lives with for the rest of her life, I wanted her to feel that somebody who had a right to feel hatred and anger did not feel that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't offering forgiveness, but I was offering a sort of just reaching out some sort of, I offered, it was a
And did
a
you get a response?
No, I didn't. I got a response from the prison authorities that said that MS West did not wish to receive further correspondence.
And how did that, what did that do for you?
I was prepared for that. Yeah. I actually wrote the letter in 2004. I didn't send it till 4 years later when I felt that, you know, I didn't have any expectations about a reply. But I did wake up one morning thinking, if I had heard that Rosemary West had died and I hadn't sent the letter, I wouldn't feel good about that.
Marina, you've been present for some of Marion's work in prisons with restorative justice. Tell us about what you've seen.
Yeah, we've worked together in male prisons. And one of the things that I found so incredibly moving is that Marion has this little woolen hand-spun bag made by her sister Lucy when they were children. And it's an incredibly special gift that she was given. And she brings it into prisons. through security. And I've watched Marion hand this bag around a group of 25 male prisoners, and each of them holding it in the palm of their hands. And it has this really profound effect, because here is this precious, delicate object being given as an act of generosity to men who are listening to Marion's stories and then are invited some of their own stories. And I think by trusting these men with an object invested with so much emotional value, Marion is somehow able to transform this story of hell into a message of hope.
And also, Marina, I think, you know, we were talking about Breonna Gye's mother this morning, and all what's been in the news, and you said, you know, we are in awe. Of course, you know, the sort of the way, the capacity to be able to react like that. But I think a lot of us are thinking, could I react like that? And surely anger is legitimate. And we're probably all thinking, could that be me? Could I actually? And listening to you as well, Marion, do I have the capacity for forgiveness?
Well, can I just say, I think I was struck also that in court, Breonna Gye's mother said that the perpetrator's mother looked completely broken.
Yeah.
And I think in that brokenness, something again cracked open in this mother's heart. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what these stories do. But forgiveness is multifaceted, multidimensional, open to interpretation, not always welcome, easily misunderstood, highly complex. I mean, in some ways, what I've been trying to do is remove the barnacles that Marion has talked about, and make forgiveness part of our emotional vocabulary, because it is actually something, it's not just for big, tragic, horrible events. It's something that we can use every day in our life around little grievances and grudges that are stuck. And in a way, that's why I've wanted to share these stories about forgiveness.
Incredibly thought-provoking interview there with Marina Cantacuzino and Marion Partington. And you can listen to Forgiveness, Tales from the Frontline on Radio 4 every day this week at 1:45. Marion's story is on tomorrow. Lots of you getting in touch with your own stories of forgiveness. Georgina said, I forgive my now late mother and maternal grandmother for not attending my wedding now nearly 40 years ago. And yes, I'm still happily married to him. I realised that it was more to their detriment than to mine. And Alice says, I decided to forgive an old friend who had let me down on multiple occasions. I decided that although I thought he was wrong and we were stuck disagreeing, I no longer needed to hold on to any stress. And in turn, I didn't want him to either. It was a great relief for me. And we never spoke again. Thanks to the forgiveness, I don't really ever think of it anymore. And another one here from Caroline says, after my husband had an affair with my close friend, I experienced deep grief and anger. The beginning of my recovery was forgiveness and the realisation that by not forgiving, I was hurting myself more than anyone else. Family and friends have found my decision to forgive very difficult, but revenge and bitterness hurts everyone. You can't heal while you hurt, and anger is unresolved. 84844. Keep your thoughts coming in on forgiveness. Maybe you haven't been able to forgive. Maybe you're in a situation right now and just listening to that interview has made you think differently about it. Whatever your thoughts, I would be appreciative of your experiences. You can also email by going to our website. Now, is this the year for women in the music industry? At the Grammys, Taylor Swift made history with her record-breaking win, winning Album of the Year for the fourth time. For Midnights. She received her award from Celine Dion, who made an unexpected appearance following her diagnosis of stiff person syndrome. Billie Eilish, SZA and Miley Cyrus also took home major awards. Even Jay-Z got in on the act with his speech calling out the fact that Beyoncé has never won Album of the Year. We can discuss them all more now. Also, a big shout out to Julia Bullock, who was on Woman's Hour a few weeks ago. She won Outstanding Classical Solo Vocal Album. So well done, Julia. Jude Rogers, arts and culture journalist for The Guardian and Observer, and Shepo Mokwena, freelance culture writer and author of Beyoncé, Lives of Musicians, join me now. Welcome to both of you. Jude, I'm going to come to you first. Before we talk about Taylor Swift, can we just mention Tracy Chapman performing with Luke Combs? I thought that was a huge moment.
Yeah, it was great to recognise the person who made this amazing song that I remember first hearing when I was 10. I remember at the Nelson Mandela concert in summer of 88, just such an amazing song. And it's amazing, I've met so many people who, in recent years, younger people who like have known it was by her. You know, it's a country song, it's Luke Combs. just to have, and he looked so delighted to be on stage with her. He was sort of in awe, and that recognition was amazing.
Yeah, Sheppo, he actually prostrated himself to her because, yeah, like you say, people didn't realise that it was written by Tracy Chapman. And is it the first time a black woman has been number one in the country charts in the States? So it's a huge moment.
Yeah.
Yes, fantastic. It was. It's Teppo, by the way. Yes, I think it's wonderful to see how social media, things like TikTok, can sort of give songs a new lease of life. And in this instance, you know, give Tracy Chapman the chance to be shown her flowers and to perform on this huge world stage. It was really, really heartwarming and always special to see her. She doesn't come out too often.
Exactly.
So that was a treat.
Exactly. So, Jude, let's talk about Taylor Swift. Record-breaking music sales. Her current tour is the first in history to surpass $1 billion in revenue. I mean, she is a powerhouse. Are we surprised that she won again last night?
No, I'm not surprised at all. I think it would have been very surprising if she hadn't won. What I liked was how she was up on stage and recognising other women. And I think the big thing we need to take home from this night is it was about women as collaborators and friends and supporting each other. She called out she was on stage, at the front of stage with Laura Sisk, her recording engineer. It was so amazing to see a female recording engineer front and centre, I thought. You know, you don't see them very often. There's still a massive discrepancies between men and women in that side of the music industry, especially their visibility. But yeah, she's won now for, let me think, Fearless, 1989, Folklore and Midnight. You know, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, she had Lana Del Rey on stage with her as well, and the way she talked about her, and that spirit seemed to be running through the night, just with all those female collaborators. You know, when SZA was on stage with Lizzo and they were talking about their early days touring together, obviously one of SZA's singles with Phoebe Bridgers, who was then with Boy Genius, the amazing female, you know, I hate to say a female band, they're a band, but they the way they ran up on stage, they were so excited, you know, and it's not the way you see women acting, you know, often at those ceremonies. They were
because we don't see them at the ceremonies that much, do we, getting on stage? So yes, it was a whole new situation. Seppo, though, let's talk about Beyonce and Jay-Z getting on stage to talk about his wife. Explain what happened.
So Jay-Z got on stage to win an award for himself, a sort of lifetime achievement award in honor of Dr. Dre in this particular case. And he used his sort of 3.5 minutes just to almost run through what felt like a stand-up routine at times. He was making sort of different jibes and jabs and then just landed the point that, you know, he was looking at his wife there in the audience, the most awarded Grammy winner of all time. She has 32 awards and no one else has ever had that many in their entire career. And he just sort of raised the question that, isn't it funny that she has never won Album of the Year? Sort of implying that the metrics that the Recording Academy uses might need to be adjusted because it doesn't really add up if somebody could be the most awarded artist on the one hand, but also have never won for Album of the Year. It was a slightly spicy interlude, but also quite interesting and honest to see someone who Jay-Z, similarly to Tracy Chapman, doesn't really speak publicly that much anymore, doesn't really do much press, keeps himself to his billionaire self. But I think it was an opportunity just to say, on the one hand, that black music, rap music was often sort of pushed to the side and shut out of the industry at the start of its, you know, reign in pop culture, and that later his wife, this black female artist, has been nominated and awarded many, many times, but she just can't seem to get her hands on the Album of the Year, even with the sort of, you know, genre-defining, boundary-breaking records that she has released.
What do you think
about
that?
So he left, you know, the Grammys with that.
What do you think?
I mean, I do think it is interesting. I think the Grammys can never really win. There can only ever be one winner in a category. And there is the sense that I think they sometimes struggle to sort of get it right for everyone. That's never going to be possible. But I do feel as though Beyoncé, in the later stage of her career that she's in now, has become more of a sort of cultural figure, almost sort of deity-like in the eyes of some. And I do think that she has given the industry so much, from the way that she just suddenly surprise released her 2014 self-titled album, which, you know, changed the way the artist approached releasing music altogether, to the visual albums that then followed. It does feel as though she does so much more than any other artist in pop, and yet she cannot seem to crack this one award. So I do think, to an extent, the fact that she is considered an R&B singer has played a part in that. She's not considered a pop artist, and you might say that is down to her race, because her music is very popular. It is very well known worldwide. But I do also concede that you know, the Recording Academy, they see the power that other artists have. They see what Taylor Swift does with her albums and that they want to award her for those. On the flip side, Taylor's never won for Song of the Year, for example, has been nominated in that category several times. So it's the sense that, you know, nobody can really win them all. Taylor might come close, but nobody really can.
No, Jude, I thought it was interesting that he decided to describe his wife as this young lady.
It made me think of, you know, the Welsh men or the Northern men I know over here in the UK. I don't, you know, I think it's just a bit of an affectionate moment, yeah. You know, I suppose, you know, kind of, but I thought it was very telling when the camera cut to her when he was doing this speech and she was straight faced and the reaction from the crowd, you know, why wasn't there cheering to acknowledge that? There was more of this sort of awkward buzz through the audience. And yeah, I think it's insane that she hasn't won Album of the Year. I absolutely agree with everything that's been said, you know, kind of, you know, she's made these albums that push at the boundaries of what an album can be while being very mainstream. She plays with genres. She does really interesting stuff. It's kind of insane. I think she should have won it 2 or 3 times myself.
What do we make of the other women who found success? Miley Cyrus won for Record of the Year and Best Pop Solo Performance for Flowers, her first ever Grammy, and SZA led the night with 9 nominations, but only won 3 of them. I mean, only 3. I say only 3. I mean, she got 3 Grammys. Still pretty good.
I love the way when SZA won at the end of her speech and she said, I'm not an attractive crier or something. And Meryl Streep, like, jumps to her feet.
Meryl Streep, who was her son-in-law's date, Mark Ronson, took his mother-in-law.
Oh, cool.
Wonderful.
You would take Meryl Streep if she was your mother-in-law.
Of course.
Though. I would, anyway.
Definitely.
But yeah, I thought there were some nice speeches from other people, like Victoria Monet, who talked about her female manager. Rochelle Jean-Louis, I think you pronounce the same, but I thought that was really great. I love this, as I mentioned about Taylor's recording engineer, this mention of the women who are in the background who aren't seen that often, and, you know, how they fought to kind of be seen and be recognised, and how her manager had to leave a company and kind of go on by herself. And I think those are the stories that are really important to remember. And the thing I worry about is that, you know, internet algorithms or whatever will only prioritize Taylor Swift, 4 albums, you know, woo. And they won't talk about the other quieter stories. And obviously, you know, but it's great that the night, so many genres, so many generations, you know, Kylie winning, you know, at 55 for a pop song is great. Joni Mitchell singing on stage, you know, everything that Joni has been through. And there were so many different women, you know, kind of who look different, who sound different, who are from different backgrounds, from all kinds of, you know, well, you know, I just still think the Grammys has to work very hard with diversity. But it was amazing to see so many women who just didn't fit into similar categories. You know, if you put a lineup of those women, it's such an amazing celebration of what different women can do with different music and different ideas.
Absolutely. Yes, Seppo.
Now, I was just going to say that I do think it is really important to recognize that celebrating wins for women isn't celebrating, you know, wins just because they are women. It's that these are just incredibly talented artists, producers, engineers, everything that you've also said too, Jude. I think it felt really compelling to see so many of the sort of rock categories going to Boy Genius. Hmm. Best Rock Album has often felt like the Foo Fighters is to lose, but, you know, Paramore picked it up this year for their album, This Is Why. I think it's just a really interesting time to see that maybe parts of the industry are starting to move away from what feel like the sort of predictable, almost easy wins in certain categories, and to show that, you know, artists can come in any shape, in any gender, in any kind of genre, and that it isn't necessarily about saying, oh, you've done well because you're a woman, or you've done well for a woman, but it's just about saying that these are artists regardless of what their gender and sex might be.
Well, it's still only
celebrating each other.
Still only early February, but I did say, could this be the year for women in the music industry? We shall see. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about the Grammys. 84844 is the number to text. Lots of you getting in touch with your stories of forgiveness. Alistair says, Marion's story is a huge reminder of what humans can be. She will stay in my mind to help me be a better person. Empathy, acceptance, forgiveness and love are what gives hope for the human race. And Ray says, I've just listened to your item on forgiveness. This was such an excellently done piece, which was enhanced by the humanity, compassion and knowledge of the participants. It has widened my view and helped me on my own difficult journey. Keep your thoughts coming through. 84844. Now, Unbecome Old. takes on the role of Emma in the new Netflix adaptation of David Nicholls' much-loved novel, One Day. She starred opposite Leo Woodall as Dex, and their funny and moving romance plays out over 14 episodes and 20 years. You may have seen Umbika previously as Shruti, the junior doctor, with a pivotal plot line in the BBC Labour War drama This Is Going to Hurt. She joins me now, Umbika. Welcome to the Woman's Hour studio.
Thank you for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure. One Day, the lead role. Congratulations. How does it feel?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years now, so it's sort of sunk in, but only just. I think it will feel weird when the show actually comes out.
This week?
Yeah, Thursday. Mm-hmm. Thursday 8th February. Yeah. Which is also the exact same day This Is Gonna Hurt came out, so it feels like a momentous...
Is it the same date?
Exactly the same date, yeah.
Are you superstitious?
So superstitious. So what? I look for meaning and like symbolism in everything. So when I heard that that was coming out on that date, I was like, huh, everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be absolutely okay.
And having watched the first few episodes and having stopped myself, otherwise I would have just stayed up all night. I mean, very tired today from watching all of it. It's very bingeable. It is going to be, you're magnificent in it.
Oh, thank you.
This Is Going to Hurt changed your life because, as I said, it was a standout role for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'd never acted before?
Well, I hadn't acted sort of professionally in that manner. You know, I've got a comedy background. I've been doing live comedy since I was 18, 19, and like writing and performing all my own stuff. And, you know, I got an agent. I was auditioning for sort of like one-line things. I did a couple of those. And This Is Gonna Hurt came out of absolutely nowhere in like lockdown. And... I think I was the last person they saw for it. I think they'd seen like every South Asian girl in the country before they'd seen me. And then my tape came in at like the 11th hour. And yeah, I ended up getting it. And it changed everything for me, for sure. It's like massively changed like the trajectory of my life in a way that I didn't anticipate happening.
And then the opportunity came to audition for Emma in One Day. And initially you said no.
Yeah.
Why?
I was just like really tired. I was tired. This Is Gonna Hurt come out. Like, that was a very overwhelming experience for me. No one ever really prepares you for that moment, especially when people really take to a show and take to your character. And I was feeling a bit emotionally, my cup overfloweth, if you will. And I remember I was like sitting on the couch in my living room, just feeling like wiped, and I saw the notification come up on my phone, like, and all I saw was like self-tape Emma One Day, and immediately I was like, no, I'm not doing that.
Because you loved the book.
I loved the book. I loved the character, and I just honestly just didn't see myself playing the role.
Tell us, for people who don't know the story, give us a very brief overview.
So the series in the book starts on 15th of July 1988, and it is the first time that two characters called Emma and Dexter meet. It's the night of their graduation from Edinburgh University. And it's the very first time they meet. They sort of spend the night together. And it sort of follows both their lives over the next 20 years on that exact same day, 15th of July, for the next 20 years. And it follows their lives and relationships and their relationship with each other.
Because it's set, we begin in 1988. The soundtrack is excellent.
Yeah.
Also, that dress you wear at the graduation,
such a special place in my heart for that dress.
It.
It's amazing. And like the way that our costume designer Maurice like styled it with like the leather belt and the 501s and the like amazing.
80s, yeah. 80s fashion.
Amazing.
Just excellent.
Yeah.
80s, but it just feels very current as well. They've done a really excellent job at styling it. And like I said, the soundtrack is incredible. Mm. Why did you think it wasn't for you though?
A lot of reasons. I honestly just didn't see myself playing a romantic lead. That's not something I really like identified myself with, especially being a comedian. Like, I've always sort of been like the self-deprecating type, and it just didn't kind of sit with me that I would be the girl that the guy, or I would play the girl that the guy fell in love with. I mean, we were just having this conversation just before, like, you know, you don't see a lot of brown women on screen being the romantic lead. You never see women like that in that position. And it's happening more and more now, for sure. But I definitely realise, like, how sort of unique this is. And it took well into the process and into filming for me to sort of be like, oh, yeah, I am this character. And I identify with her in so many ways. Like, I reread the book when I was auditioning and I was like, we're so similar. Like, there's no way, there's no reason he couldn't beat me. So, but it definitely took a while. And it wasn't until I watched it that I was like, oh, yeah, this sort of makes sense. Yeah.
When I watched it, I had a huge moment of taking it in because I thought this is the first time I'm seeing a South Asian woman playing the romantic lead. And maybe if I'd seen this as a child, I might have believed that, you know, my space in society is different or that the guy could even fancy you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's so much... I think the value of seeing yourself on screen is not one to be underestimated. I think it informs so much about how we look at ourselves, how we think about ourselves, what we think we deserve, especially for like young women of colour. I think seeing someone like Emma, and you know, this isn't a story that just revolves around her relationship with Dexter. You know, it's about her and her ambitions and her working really hard and following her dreams and failing and.
Because he's from an incredibly privileged background.
Totally. Like, the opposition is, like, he is from an incredibly, incredibly privileged background. He has everything given to him on a silver platter, and he sort of wastes that opportunity, whereas Emma has all the capabilities in the world but just doesn't have the access to do much with it, at the beginning anyway. And, you know, we see her working terrible jobs and...
Could you relate to any of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I graduated from uni, I was, like, working full-time jobs and then gigging in the evenings and writing on the weekends and, like, doing Fringe every year and, you know, because you need to make money. A girl's got to eat. So, I was, you know, waking up at like 7 a.m. and then going to work and then going to a gig and coming back at like 11 p.m. and then doing it all the next day. And most of the day I was in jobs that I didn't like, that didn't fulfill me, thinking about one day hopefully doing this full time. And, it feels very... Do you know what's really weird is we filmed... some of this in Edinburgh, and we did spend a couple of days at the top of Arthur's Seat, and so I've done a lot of Edinburgh Fringes.
Yeah.
And every year when I do Fringe, like, whoever's up there, my friends, we always like climb Arthur's Seat on the very last day. So Edinburgh and Arthur's Seat especially has a very special place in my heart, and the last time I was there was 2019. I wasn't feeling good about life. I was feeling really lost, and then literally 3 years later, almost exactly, I'm at the top of Arthur's Seat filming the lead in one day. And it was just like this incredible, like, full circle moment. And I just think if you believe in magic, it will happen. And that felt like a very...
These coincidences.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, these synchronicities. If you look for them, they're there.
But I really love the phrase, luck favours the brave.
It does, yeah.
So you've obviously worked very hard. And thank goodness you decided to take the audition.
Yeah, for sure. There wasn't like a reason why I changed my mind. I just sort of remember like... sitting up in bed one night and thinking of that I made a terrible mistake. And then as the audition process went on, I was like, I want this so much. Also because, like, it was by far and away the best, most interesting role that I was being offered after This Is Gonna Hurt. Because there aren't a lot of interesting roles for brown women out there.
And I read, and I think this is, you can tell me if I've if it's true, that you have actually actively turned down roles where you're playing the sort of sidekick to the white female lead. But that takes confidence as someone who's just starting out, because actually most of us just think, well, I'll just take the work.
Yeah.
Any work.
For sure. But I think, I don't know. I've always had a belief that, like, if you do something, you should always try to do the same or better. And with This Is Gonna Hurt, like, that was such a superlative show in so many ways, especially with the role that I played. And I just didn't feel that a lot of the roles I was being seen for after that were living up to that. And, you know, the three-dimensional humanity that we achieved with that character and her experiences. I didn't want to be, like you say, a sidekick. I didn't want to be there to facilitate the plot. Yeah. I wanted to play... It was, for me, it was all character-based. It's all character-driven, the way that I, you know, gravitate towards things and gravitate towards projects and... Yeah, I think that's probably why one day stuck out to me.
Yeah, stick to your guns. Greta Lee, who won a Golden Globe for her lead role in Past Lives, when she accepted it, she said, this is the first time where I've been able to tell a story of a Southeast Asian character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And not the sidekick.
Yeah.
It was a big moment. The character is also from Leeds.
Yeah.
You're not?
I'm not from Leeds.
I'm from Bradford, but we could do the rest of the interview in a West Yorkshire accent.
Oh, no. We could try.
How was it mastering the accent?
You know, it was like, for me, that was maybe one of the biggest things of me being like, I can't do this part. I can't do a Leeds accent. Can't do a Yorkshire accent. And if you watch my audition tapes, I just can't do it. I can't do
what you're doing.
Oh, just a bad Yorkshire accent. I was sort of speaking like this all the time. It just wasn't very good. And then I remember, like, I was waiting to hear if I'd got it, and my agent called me being like, they really love you, but obviously there's like concern about the accent. And I was like, well, obviously, like, it's not a good accent. So they were like, they want you to meet with a dialect coach, and she's going to sign you off. And so I met with a dialect coach on a Saturday evening, and I spent the whole day watching Educating Yorkshire, and I spent like an hour with her, and she was like, to be honest, I don't really know what they want from me. Like, you could obviously learn this accent, like, it's going to be fine. And then I got it a couple of days later, but then as soon as I got it, like, I went into like full-on sessions with her. She was so amazing. Her name's Natalie Grady. And we did like 3 days a week, and then we were just like militant throughout the whole process, not just in terms of figuring out the accent, but then figuring out an accent that works for Emma.
Yeah.
And then tapering it as the series went on. And
well, it just says a huge amount about your talent and what you bring to screen that they said, well, we want her because it's your eyes, Ambika.
Oh,
they're incredible.
Thank you.
You just bring us in. This is going to, I feel, I'm making a prediction that, you know, big things change your life. Are you ready?
I don't know. I can't really see past this Thursday, to be honest. But if people get the show, then that'll make me very happy.
Well, I mean, not that, you know, I mean, it's woman. You're on Woman's Hour. Yeah. We're having a chat. Graham Norton.
Oh, yeah. These are big things. I do that this Thursday. I'm really scared. Yeah. No. No.
Got your outfit sorted?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. But I'm nervous. It's such a big deal, Graham Norton. But I met him on Saturday and he's a lovely, lovely man. But I am nervous. Yeah.
You're allowed to be.
I'm allowed to be.
But enjoy it as well.
Thank you.
I'm thrilled for you. And come back and talk to us anytime.
Anytime. Thank you so much, Anita.
Thank you, Ambika. Ambika Mode. All the episodes of One Day are released on Netflix this Thursday, the 8th of February. You're going to love it. Thank you. Now, have you ever heard of grantinatal classes? They give grandparents the chance to brush up on practical skills and get key advice on how to look after young kids again. Dr. Francesca Dooley is the founder of Happy Parents, Happy Baby, where she runs grandparent classes. And the first one she ever did was for her mum, Beverly Bonora, and some of her friends. They both join me now. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
Francesca, tell us all about this. Grantinatal classes, where did the idea come from?
Yes, so it's interesting, really. I think the idea was coming from two directions. And as you mentioned, we run sort of antenatal classes already. And something that was really coming through with so many parents was how much they were relying on grandparents for their kind of involvement with their children. And this was anything from being birth partners, you know, to coming to stay with them for short time whilst, you know, they're getting to grips with new parenthood, people that were moving in with their parents, and also people that were just planning to, you know, ask their parents to have the baby for the night so they could have a break, or, you know, to be taking over with long-term childcare. So on one hand, we had parents saying, we're asking a lot from, you know, the grandparents, and, you know, we really want them to be prepared and learn all the things that we've been learning. And then on the other hand, we had grandparents contacting us saying, can we book onto your courses? Because, you know, we're going to be looking after young babies again. And for lots of people, you know, people are leaving it later to have children. So some of them haven't cared for a baby for, you know, many years. And, you know, saying, you know, it's a big responsibility. And we actually feel like, you know, a bit anxious about the thought of doing this again.
I mean, so many questions are coming to mind. I'm going to bring your mum in. Beverly, Beverly, how should we interpret that your daughter put you on this course?
I think it was she was working on it to start off. I said, actually, I've got a couple of friends, well, actually three friends that are going to be new grandparents, and they've got no idea how things have changed. Do you not think it'd be a good idea to run a course for grandparents? So I brought them along, and we did the first course, and it was really good.
And what are the key things that you were learning then? What things, when they said things have changed, like what? Because you just people just presume it's just a natural thing, isn't it? You become a grandparent and you just know how to be a grandparent. Like, what were the things that you needed to learn?
Well, things have changed so much. The way you lay a baby when it sleeps, car seats, feeding, nap, even how to put a nappy on, because, you know, which is the front of the nappy, which is the back of the nappy. It's, you know, it's all, everything has changed so much since when I had children and these other people had children. Yeah, it's a lot. If you're looking after someone else's baby, you want to do it properly and you want them to, the babies to be safe. But the main thing was the first aid, because, you know, if a baby's choking or if it stops breathing, if it's unwell, a temperature, and you can't always phone your daughter or daughter-in-law because they're working. In Francesca's case, she was at the hospital, so she can't just stop and say, oh, Mum, you need to do this, that or the other. So, yeah, it was very informative. Yeah. I found it very informative.
You mentioned there, because Francesca's at the hospital, because Francesca, you and your husband, Will, who you run the course together, you're both doctors. Have there been big changes from a medical standpoint about how you look after young kids?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And we always kind of start the courses by saying to the grandparents, you know, lots of things have changed, but babies haven't. And you've done all this before. It's going to be like getting back onto, you know, riding a bike in many ways. However, you know, if you spend a couple of hours on this course, talking to other grandparents, maybe, you know, there are things in common that you're worrying about. And we can kind of update you on certain things, then, you know, you can go into this whole process feeling a lot more confident, a lot more happy. And that's why we called it Happy Grandparents, Happy Baby. And the main things that grandparents want to know are safety. So first aid is a big one. They tell us that they want to know about guidelines. So, for instance, you know, 30 years ago, people did put babies to sleep on their front. And there were big campaigns in the 90s, which have, you know, made huge kind of differences to the way that we do things. Car seats weren't even, you know, I think my mum said, we used to just put you in a carry cot on the back seat of the car. It wasn't until sort of 2006 that people had to put a baby in a car seat. So safety is a big one. Technology, you know, walking into a shop or a supermarket and suddenly there are just rows and rows of baby products that just didn't really exist, you know, being handed baby monitors by your, you know, what do I do with this? So all of the technology's changed, and also attitudes, you know, things like men are a lot more involved than they used to be. And, you know, grandfathers are now saying, hang on, we want to be involved as well. You know, it's not fair that we didn't get to do that. So can we join in?
So how do you tackle that, the sort of changing attitudes and parenting styles? I'm thinking there's a lot of sort of, it sounds like a lot of therapy might be involved in this, talking to grandparents, how to communicate with your children.
It's a big one. And you know what? It works both ways, because a lot of grandparents are saying to us, you know, oh, how do I know if I'm going to do the right thing, say the right thing? But then, you know, they're also kind of worried about their own boundaries. You know, how much should I agree to take on? You know, maybe they're in their 70s, their 80s, and, you know, they're being asked to have babies overnight or have babies for long periods of time. So we do, you know, and the grandparents give each other advice about how they're kind of playing things in their family. And yeah, it's really useful. I think everybody comes out of it just feeling a bit more reassured and kind of thinking about what they want to do.
Exactly. And also, Beverly, I mean, we talk about it a lot on this programme, the cost of living and the cost of childcare means that more and more people now are having to rely on grandparents to help out with the kids.
Exactly. I think, and also it works both ways, because you get so much pleasure from looking after your grandchild and you form such a strong bond that I think it's an honour as well to be asked, but not too often.
And have things changed since your own experience of raising Francesca? How did it feel taking on the grandkids?
As I said, it was lovely. I mean, Francesca's got three babies and I've looked after all of them. And I'm, in fact, this afternoon, I'm going to pick three of them up from three different schools. So, yes, I'm very heavily involved. But I class myself as very lucky.
And what about the communication between the two of you, Francesca?
Yeah, I mean,
it's always been smooth.
Yeah, I think we're lucky, really. I think, you know what, I remember, and I kind of talk about this on the grandparents course, I think before I had children, I was very kind of thinking, you know, this is fine, I'm going to be fine. And I remember my mum saying to me, shall I come and stay on that first night you come home from the hospital? I said, no, we'll be fine. Like, we need to do this. So we get home, go to bed, lay the baby in this new crib, and the baby just would not stop crying. And it got to about 3 o'clock in the morning. And of course, you know, I called my mum. So she drove an hour in the dark, got handed a screaming baby. And, you know, we were exhausted, Will and I. And, you know, we just said, can you just watch her breathe so we can sleep? And a few hours later, we woke up and the baby was all calm and settled. And, you know, so grandparents are amazing and they've got so many skills.
Yes.
And this is really just about, you know,
grandparents are amazing. But I have to say, based on what you're saying, Francesca, your mum is amazing. Driving an hour through the night to help you out, picking three kids up from three different schools. This is top grandparenting.
Yeah, and she's also got my brother and his three children living with her at the moment whilst they're moving house. So she
Beverly, will you be my grandma too, please?
Just for me.
And very quickly, Beverly, top tips for any grandparents to be?
Patient, guidelines. Because that's very important as they're growing up. Boundaries, obviously. Just be loving and caring and be the best you can.
Wonderful advice.
And all the treat, giving them all the things that we don't.
Exactly.
Thank you both for speaking to me this morning. Yes. Wonderful. Really enjoyed that. That's Dr. Frances Dooley and her mum Beverly talking about grandparent classes. Woman's Hour is back tomorrow from 10, where you can hear Emma speak to a woman whose ex-partner is due to be released from prison despite a parole board panel saying in November it would not be safe to do so. Rhiannon Bragg was held at gunpoint for 8 hours by her former partner. So do join Emma for that tomorrow. Thank you. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
The Post Office Horizon scandal has shocked Britain.
Post Office IT scandal, which has had so much publicity, hasn't it, over the last...
This is a scandal of historic proportions.
I've been following the story for more than a decade, hearing about the suffering of sub-postmasters like Joe Hamilton and Alan Bates.
It was just horrendous. The whole thing was horrendous.
I was told you can't afford to take on Post Office.
And about their extraordinary fight for justice.
What was motivating you?
Well, it was wrong what they did.
Listen to the true story firsthand from the people who lived it in the Great Post Office Trial from BBC Radio 4 with me, Nick Wallace. Subscribe on BBC Sounds.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.